Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. In episode 11, we are at Deakin Edge in Melbourne's Federation Square, where the Moon Village Association is hosting a panel discussion about medicine and the Moon.
My name's Dr. Mark Gerblum. I'm a psychiatry doctor working at St. Vincent's Hospital here. I'm also a member of the Space Life Sciences Committee for the Australasian Society of Aerospace Medicine. The world we live in is changing incredibly swiftly. This has been incredibly apparent for myself because I've recently had a young daughter, and it's really brought this into focus for me as I've been looking at her and thinking about the world that I grew up in, where we had the space shuttle, and we've seen 20 years almost of people continuously in orbit in the space station. And the next decades are going to be incredibly changed. There's going to be incredible change. We're going to see the return to the Moon, the reaching out towards Mars, and then the first stages of human settlement. Now, this might come within a decade if we listen to the optimism of Elon Musk, or it might take a few decades, but this work is inexorable, and the opportunities that arise in its wake are incredible possibilities for us to drive forward things back home. So obviously our interest is in healthcare and where that is going to be impacted by space research. The Space Life Sciences Committee has got two goals. The first is to look at Australia's work in all aspects of healthcare and human environments, and see how we can look at supporting Australia and having a part in the missions that are going to take place, the international missions back to the Moon and onwards after that. The second is to use those opportunities to channel that research into improving all aspects of healthcare in our environment, and to generate useful intellectual property and advances in our hospitals and other healthcare resources. There's many questions that need to be answered from a medical point of view. People are going to get injured on missions as they do, back here. So how do you treat someone in a spacesuit on the surface of the Moon? How do you get them back into a habitat? When you don't have a hospital of resources, how do you help them? And then on a bigger picture, how do you create a sustainable closed environment, an environment where a human can live, where we'd like to have completely recyclable food, air and water? And then how does that technology affect how we can be more sustainable here on Earth? Australia is incredibly well placed for this research. Our remote medical care and work in isolated areas is something we're all quite familiar with. I'm sure you've all heard of the Royal Flying Doctors. Many of you have heard of the Australian Antarctic Division. Supporting people in hard-to-reach places is a mark of pride in this country, and those resources are perfect for translation into this sort of work. So to start giving you a taste of some of these challenges, and how Australian researchers are looking to address them, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Dr. Gordon Cable is a specialist in aerospace medicine, a senior aviation medical officer for both the Defence Force and the Royal Australian Air Force. and currently head of aerospace medicine training at the RAF Institute of Aviation Medicine. Gordon is also the founding chair of the Space Life Sciences Committee and works tirelessly each year on top of his usual workload to convene our annual Humans in Space Bioastronautics course. He's a fellow of the Australasian College of Aerospace Medicine, the Aerospace Medical Association, the Royal Aeronautical Society, the International Academy of Aviation and Space Medicine. Additionally, he's a clinical associate professor at the School of Medicine at the University of Adelaide and a senior lecturer at the University of Tasmania. In 2005, he was appointed a member of the Order of Australia for his contributions in the area of aerospace medicine. His professional interests are in altitude physiology of hypoxia and hyperbaric decompression illness, hypoxia awareness training for military and civilian air crews, that's lack of oxygen for anyone who's not familiar with the word, and postgraduate education in aerospace medicine for many medical professionals, where he's a mentor for myself and many, many of my colleagues. Gordon will be speaking about the effects of the space environment on the human body. So with that, I'd like to invite Gordon Cable. My name's Dr. Mark Gerblum. I'm a psychiatry doctor working at St. Vincent's Hospital here. I'm also a member of the Space Life Sciences Committee for the Australasian Society of Aerospace Medicine. The world we live in is changing incredibly swiftly. This has been incredibly apparent for myself because I've recently had a young daughter, and it's really brought this into focus for me as I've been looking at her and thinking about the world that I grew up in, where we had the space shuttle, and we've seen 20 years almost of people continuously in orbit in the space station. And the next decades are going to be incredibly change. There's going to be incredible change. We're going to see the return to the moon, the reaching out towards Mars, and then the first stages of human settlement. Now, this might come within a decade if we listen to the optimism of Elon Musk, or it might take a few decades, but this work is inexorable, and the opportunities that arise in its wake are incredible possibilities for us to drive forward things back home. So obviously our interest is in healthcare and where that is going to be impacted by space research. The Space Life Sciences Committee has got two goals. The first is to look at Australia's work in all aspects of healthcare and human environments, and see how we can look at supporting Australia and having a part in the missions that are going to take place, the international missions back to the moon and onwards after that. The second is to use those opportunities to channel that research into improving all aspects of healthcare in our environment and to generate useful intellectual property and advances in our hospitals and other healthcare resources. There's many questions that need to be answered from a medical point of view. People are going to get injured on missions as they do, back here. So how do you treat someone in a spacesuit on the surface of the moon? How do you get them back into a habitat? When you don't have a hospital of resources, how do you help them? And then on a bigger picture, how do you create a sustainable closed environment, an environment where a human can live, where we'd like to have completely recyclable food, air and water? And then how does that technology affect how we can be more sustainable here on Earth? Australia is incredibly well placed for this research. Our remote medical care and work in isolated areas is something we're all quite familiar with. I'm sure you've all heard of the Royal Flying Doctors. Many of you have heard of the Australian Antarctic Division. Supporting people in hard-to-reach places is a mark of pride in this country, and those resources are perfect for translation into this sort of work. So to start giving you a taste of some of these challenges and how Australian researchers are looking to address them, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Dr. Gordon Cable is a specialist in aerospace medicine, a senior aviation medical officer for both the Defence Force and the Royal Australian Air Force, and currently head of aerospace medicine training at the RAF Institute of Aviation Medicine. Gordon is also the founding chair of the Space Life Sciences Committee and works tirelessly each year on top of his usual workload to convene our annual Humans in Space Bioastronautics course. He's a fellow of the Australasian College of Aerospace Medicine, the Aerospace Medical Association, the Royal Aeronautical Society, the International Academy of Aviation and Space Medicine. Additionally, he's a clinical associate professor at the School of Medicine at the University of Adelaide and a senior lecturer at the University of Tasmania. In 2005, he was appointed a member of the Order of Australia for his contributions in the area of aerospace medicine. His professional interests are in altitude physiology of hypoxia and hyperbaric decompression illness, hypoxia awareness training for military and civilian air crews. That's lack of oxygen for anyone who's not familiar with the word. And postgraduate education in aerospace medicine for many medical professionals, where he's a mentor for myself and many, many of my colleagues. Gordon will be speaking about the effects of the space environment on the human body. I'd like to introduce our second speaker. Dr. Rowena Christensen is another member of the Space Life Science Committee. She's a medical educator at the Melbourne Medical School. She also works as a pre-hospital emergency doctor and life support instructor. She's undertaken postgraduate training in emergency medicine, crit care, women and children's health, aviation medicine, space studies, and disaster health and emergency management. Rowena has interests in aerospace medicine, extreme environments, and wilderness medicine. She's the chair of the Australian Ski Patrol Association Medical Advisory Committee and sits on the Australian Resuscitation Council and the Board of Directors for the Mars Society Australia and the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Management. Rowena is currently undertaking research related to expeditionary medicine and resuscitation science. Her career trajectory prior to entering medicine was as a lawyer and businesswoman. Rowena is going to give us an introduction into how we actually provide medical care in space and some of the challenges we need to overcome in order to support human spaceflight to the moon. Dr. Omar Eduardo Rodriguez, like myself, he's a medical doctor working in psychiatry. He's currently a neuroradiology registrar at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and a pre-fellow of the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. He completed a Bachelor of Medicine and Economics and then went on to become a Director of Management and Development at St. John of God Health Organization. Then after a few years, decided to pursue his lifelong aspiration in the space industry and neurosciences. Then he pursued pilot training as well as completed a Master's in Space Studies with the International Space University in France. Then in 2017, he enrolled in the Southern Hemisphere Space Studies Program, which is held annually in Adelaide, which quite a few people in the room, I think, are graduates of. He is a former scholar and researcher from NASA Ames, where he worked in the Fatigue Countermeasures Laboratory. He also participated in a Mars medical analog mission as crew health and neuropsychiatry officer. He was also selected by the International Institute for Astronautical Science in the United States as a scientist astronaut candidate, and his research interests are in fatigue, sleep studies, and the broader neuropsychiatry aspects of space in analog missions and in parabolic flight. Dr. Rodriguez is going to take a slightly different tact as he speaks about a very important but often overlooked area of human space flight. That of being confined in a spacecraft, being surrounded by the dangers of a different environment, and the immense toll this takes on the psychological health of astronauts, which can place the entire mission in jeopardy if not managed properly. So I'd like to introduce our final speaker. Quinn is a data scientist, technologist, and clinical researcher. He's worked as a scientist for the European Space Agency and has only recently returned from the European Astronaut Centre in Cologne, Germany. His space medicine research includes investigating hypergravity-related physiology to inform the development of effective countermeasures to maintain the health of future astronauts on long-duration deep space missions to the Moon and to Mars. He has 10 years of experience working as a management consultant across healthcare, health services, aerospace, and nonprofit sectors. He holds a master's in organizational psychology, a master's in information systems, and is currently completing a medical doctorate. He's also authored 20 medical research papers. His presentation today is titled A Field Guide to Exploring the Moon as a Deep Space Astronaut, and is intended to give you a feel for what it might be like for one of humanity's next great envoys as we forge deep into the solar system, take our next tentative steps on the surface of another planet, and see a lunar-based Earth rise again for the first time in half a century. One of those next envoys of humanity could be one of yourselves. So without further ado, I'd like to open up the main part of the session, which is to yourselves. And so I'd like to invite any questions at all. There's no question too small, so feel free to put your hand up and direct your questions to either one of our speakers or the whole panel.
Good afternoon. To Dr. Cable, question about oxygen. Now, the partial pressure is 21%. So I wanted to know, how low a pressure can we go and maintain that partial pressure to get enough oxygen, or how low a pressure can we go to with enriched oxygen before oxygen becomes too toxic?
So percentage and partial pressure, I'll just clarify, the fractional concentration of oxygen in the room right now is 21%. The partial pressure is 160 millimetres of mercury, whatever other that means in hectopascals. The percentage is kind of the key here in a way. So you can enrich an atmosphere to in excess of 21% if you reduce the pressure, but you have to be aware of the fire risk is the main problem. We all know Apollo 1 and what happened to Apollo 1, right? So when you start enriching an environment, it starts to get a bit problematic. But you can drop a pressure down to probably, let's say an equivalent of 15,000 feet on Earth, which if you enrich the concentration of oxygen you are breathing a little bit, is actually quite acceptable. It's like, when you go on, climb a mountain, you go to terrestrial altitude, the pressure of the oxygen is dropping around you. We can tolerate and adapt to that. If you oxygen enrich it a little bit, it's helpful because it helps wash nitrogen out of the body, which is protective from decompression illness as well. So it is certainly doable. You probably wouldn't want to do it lower pressure than about in a 15,000 foot equivalent, because if you enrich the oxygen too much, you start ending up with a fire risk, a fire hazard in a spacecraft.
I guess my question is, what is the minimum total pressure you can have of atmosphere, of whatever your oxygen dilutant mix is, before the amount of oxygen itself becomes too toxic? What's the lowest pressure you can have with the highest percentage of oxygen?
Okay, so I'm not sure of the exact data on that. The oxygen is toxic only in high concentrations for long periods of time. So you can breathe 100% oxygen for some hours and have no effect of that. You wouldn't want to be breathing that for months or days even. It would be toxic in that situation. The lowest pressure, I think, to minimise the risk of decompression illness would be no lower than an equivalent of about 18,000 feet on Earth. But they're not. The risk then becomes hypobarrier, risk of decompression illness, nitrogen bubbling out of your body. The risk at a 2-to-1 pressure change, about 18,000 feet, starts to increase. Once you get to a 3-to-1 pressure change, which is about 25,000 foot equivalent on Earth, then there is a very steep elbow in the risk curve, and you would have a substantial chance of getting clinical decompression illness at that point.
This question's probably directed at Rowena. When you mentioned nutrition in space, you touched on the gut health, and I was wondering, with extended periods of time in space in a fully sterile environment, does that have a negative effect on the immune system if you're not taking in new bacteria and new germs into your system? And also, maybe in the same thread, is there a chance that bacterial viruses could mutate on long trips into space, and then could the astronauts bring back those different strains of whatever it is and infect people on Earth?
Thanks for the questions. I'll just answer the last part first, and there certainly is research which has been done in relation to bacteria and viruses to show that they do evolve and mutate in the space environment, and that they actually become more virulent than the ones that we have here on Earth. So what would happen over a very long period? I imagine that they would continue to mutate, and possibly not in ways which are good for us. And going back to the question of the gut microbiome, it's also thought that because your immune system does become less efficient and is affected in a negative way in extreme environments like being in space, that there would also be a negative effect on the gut microbiome. And so that would require support. Nutritionally is one way that we can do it, but of course you raise a really important point about taking in environmental bacteria as sort of positive stimuli for our immune system. And I think there's also a really interesting question of what if we strike new bacteria or new viruses which have evolved on another world, and how we're going to interact with that. And I always like to think of the example of the War of the Worlds, the H.G. Wells book, and you might have seen the movie, that it's actually the Earth bacteria that end up killing the Martian invaders. So would the same thing happen to us on a foreign world? I think it's all very interesting to think about. And if we do discover life on Mars, for instance, those sort of questions will come into play in a very realistic way.
Actually, I might just contribute too. I think planetary protection works in two ways. There's the potential for Earth contamination of other worlds, such as the Moon or Mars, but then, of course, we're concerned about bringing, as you say, viruses or bacteria, which are extraterrestrial, back to the planet. So we are concerned about contamination of, one would assume, pristine worlds, but they may not. They may have their own life. And if we do find life on another planetary body, Moon or Mars, the question has to be asked then, did we introduce it accidentally, or is it actually native, indigenous life that was there? So that's always going to be a question, and that's where planetary protection comes in. But just a comment about the immune system. There was a study done recently that shows both innate and cellular immunity in humans decreases in remote environments. So Antarctica, for example, people wintering over there have a decrease in immune function, as astronauts also do. And a recent study shows that natural killer cells, which are the cells that kill malignant cells that crop up in your body, they don't work as well. So clearly there's a concern there with the radiation effect, malignancies arising and having decreased that sort of innate immunity. It's a concern.
Also, I can say that the virus that we have, they can reactivate in our body as well. So this study has shown that the immune system reduced, and some virus like herpes or Epstein virus, they can reappear in space. It would be one of the dangers that we have deep space exploration.
From Federation Square in the heart of Melbourne, the topic of the day is medicine and the moon.
Just a question from my side. From a longer-term perspective, is there any chance if humans are born off-world that they won't be able to go back to Earth? And longer-term, if we've got generations of humans living in space, could they branch off into like a separate species?
That's a very good question. I think the answer to that question, I mean, clearly we don't know, but the answer to that question, thinking logically about humans, how humans adapt and evolve, I think the logical answer is yes, we will. I mean, if humans do colonize and we work out how to reproduce on another world in a completely different gravity environment, radiation environment, pressure and oxygen environment, then the adaptations that we make, I think we'll see potentially a different subspecies of human evolve as a result of that. So our cardiovascular system will evolve differently. Our bone and muscle structure will evolve differently. But the question is, how does the reproductive process actually work in that environment? As so much of what we do in a reproductive physiology sense relies upon a 1G environment in many ways. So we have a lot of problems to solve, but there's very little hard evidence or research that can inform us about that at this point. I think it's going to be one of those things that we discover by doing. It's hard to simulate that on Earth.
And I might just add an extra point too. There's a concern about the effect that cosmic radiation can have on the germ cells, the cells that we actually use to reproduce with, and the possibility of DNA damage or mutations, which would then be passed on to offspring. So we've still got a lot of things to think about, I think, before we actually encourage people to reproduce in a inner space environment.
Thank you very much for your briefing and presentation. I'm sure we all, as a crew, feel prepared now. My question, I guess, to all of you, it has been inspired by Dr. Christensen's reference to the dome or the water-filled hood for surgical procedures, and also relating to the architectures that we know water will play an important radiation shielding role. Can you foresee or imagine a future lunar EVA water-filled or fluid-filled suit, like an extra blister, where we start to incorporate skin conditioning health fluids around the body as an extra body as well?
I think that's a really, really interesting question, a really interesting concept. And I'm just thinking of a movie, I can't think of the name of it at the moment, where they actually breathe in a liquid that supplied all the...
The abyss.
The abyss, yeah, supplied all the oxygen that they needed. And so I guess there's the possibility of something like that. I guess water is heavy, so the idea of having to carry around an extra fluid-filled shell, the sort of mechanical aspect of that, I guess you would need to think about in terms of whether the astronaut can actually carry that in addition to everything else. Spacesuits are already very, very heavy, but in terms of protecting them, I think that's a really interesting idea.
I think it does come down to functionality. Wearing something like that would make it very difficult from a mobility point of view with the astronauts, although in microgravity water doesn't weigh anything. They've certainly explored other radio protective materials which are lighter. Boron nitrile nanotubes and so on have been looked at. There's some other materials which are radio protective. But in terms of using water, the main strategy has been looking at encasing or surrounding astronaut habitats in the water supply and or fuel supply of the spacecraft, or habitat as hydrogen in whatever form, water or fuel, is the key. It's the protective element. I think a water-filled suit would be a challenge, a great idea, but we've certainly looked at water-filled suits in a terrestrial environment for the protection of pilots from the effects of G, because of the way hydrostatic pressure forces work in our 1G environment. Wearing a fluid-filled suit as a fighter pilot is actually a very good thing to do. But again, it comes down to wearability, practicality, how heavy it is. There was a suit developed in Europe called the Lebel suit, which had some very, very fine ribs of fluid running up and down it, which did provide some very good G protection, but it actually wasn't superior to the other technologies, such as the pneumatic G suit plus pressure breathing. So it was not taken on board as a technology, but an interesting thought for radiation protection.
Yeah, so it is an interesting thought, and there are people certainly, as you probably know, working on these kinds of questions currently. It was interesting, we had a briefing from Matthias Mara, one of the most recent recruits to the European Astronaut Corps in Germany over Christmas, and his challenge to us as scientists was to come up with a functional EVA skin suit, a new space suit that's easy to move around in, that's light, and that can facilitate, you know, any kind of action that we take for granted here on Earth. So I think that one of the biggest risks with a fluid-filled spacesuit would be mobility, yeah, and weight, and the other issues that the other people on this panel have already mentioned.
The astronaut Edgar Mitchell, reported a strange altered state that he experienced. This has led to a strange and kind of suspicious subculture, but it leads to the question, can the concatenation of all of these effects induce in humans a mental altered state that we're not familiar with?
Perfect question for the psychiatrists. While they're considering their answer, I think it's interesting.
I'll start answering that on behalf of Eduardo. Was it a question about how the space environment might alter a perception called create altered perceptions, altered sense of reality potentially?
Thank you so much for the question. There are different experiences that astronauts have in space. Because of the change of the fluids in the body. There's an explanation. We really don't know. There is some change in the vision, particularly. When they see the surroundings, it's different than where we see. And some explanation is because the fluids inside our brain change, and in fact, the brain moves. So not only the fluid that we have, we can say like free water, inside the brain change, but also the brain moves. This moving of the brain made the ocular globe to be more flat, and this made the perception to be different. So there are different changes of the perception. One is the vision, which actually astronauts had problem to see the 3D dimension. So they had problem when they are going to, you know, to land a plane after they came from space, they had difficulties. There was a study. It was published in January this year, 2019, and this study showed 7 astronauts. They did an MRI, so an image in the brain, and they show how the fluid change in the brain and how the test they did was to drive a car in computer simulate, and no one could pass the test. All the astronauts failed the test because of the perception, the vision change, the 3D change. This is in regards of the eye. Now let's go to say about the ears, the sound. When they go to space, the sound change. There are different reasons. One is because our vestibular system actually changed in space, and there are some problems with our vestibular system. In our brain, the two elements in our brain change are the cerebellum and the vestibular system. They are the most compromised parts of the brain in space. So because of that, they have problems localizing things in 3D, but also to perceive the sound. The perception of the sound is different. Another element is color, the color change in space. And there are different studies shown why, because it's the same phenomenon, because of the compression the increase of the pressure in the brain. So the perception of the color change in astronauts in space. So this kind of thing, you know, like color, the taste change, even the smell can change. So this is why one of the problems is that when astronauts are in space, the cognitive status decline because all the surrounding change. How they see things are different. How the sound is different. And this is why the performance is getting less and they have some problem with the performance. This is why many systems have redundant system. You know, they can made like twice or three times to be sure that the system.
The altered perception actually could be for good, not necessarily, you know, nefarious, in the sense that if you talk to the astronaut corps who have returned from space, they almost to a person report a phenomenon that we know as the overview effect. I don't know whether you've heard of that, which is a well-documented phenomenon, and it's not something, it's not a perceptual change whilst they're there. It tends to occur once they're home, but I think it comes from the fact that you are viewing your home planet from a distance, and the moon even more so than low Earth orbit, and yet it happens in low Earth orbit as well. Astronauts return with a perception of the fragility of our planet, the thinness of our atmosphere as our only life support system, the sense that our planet is our only lifeboat in this cosmos of threat and risk and radiation, and a sense that there are no borders on this planet. And when they're on the ISS, they look down on the world and they don't think of it as my country, they just think of it as us. And it's that perception, I think, which speaks to the value of exploration. It's not so much about what we learn of the planets we go to, it's more about what we learn about us. And I think that's the altered perception that happens to astronauts generally.
And it's very interesting because a study published in 2014 they showed that there is no religious concept. Actually, they don't think about religious. There is not. The study showed, and they did an interview to many astronauts, that the religious doesn't change, but the concept in regards to the air changed. You know, how to look after the air, how to protect our air. It's very interesting. The other phenomenon is called the salutation. I think you know about that. The salutation is, you know, when person goes, particularly in space, in a very difficult environment, they can create some very strong qualities. And these strong qualities is a positive effect of the situation in space to become positive in the life and to become quite positive when they came back to the Earth.
The overview effect almost affected the whole planet on Christmas Eve in 1968 when Apollo 8 sent back those pictures of Earthrise from the moon, Apollo 8 orbiting the moon, sent back the images, and that made an enormous change, in fact, I think, in the Earth's, the population's perception of our planet, and in some ways perhaps even kick-started the conservation of our planet kind of movement on the Earth. So it's a very interesting phenomenon, but yeah, I think it's going to be even more prominent the deeper we go into space and the further we go from home.
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting question, and certainly as we move into deep space exploration, there are a lot of unknowns, right? That question of concatenation and the effect of on the psychology of astronauts really is an unknown. But my hypothesis as a psychologist, and you know, interacting with the European Astronaut Corps and chatting to some of NASA's astronauts, is that I think the effect will be minimal, right? Unless we're spending years on Mars. It's important to bear in mind that it's really just a job. It's people doing a job. You speak to Tim Peake and you ask him, you know, how he felt and whether it changed his life upon returning from his time on ISS. And he's a pragmatic guy. He has a very clear sense of what it means and how it's affected him. And he's very. I think what I'm trying to say is that it's very easy to get academic about these kinds of questions, and without being there on the ground and seeing these people, meeting these people, and you're probably extremely experienced with this kind of thing. But you know, for some of us, it's easy to think that it has more of a profound impact than I suspect it really does. Another thing to bear in mind too is that these people are strictly selected. So you're looking for people who are stable psychologically and supremely stable medically, right? So you're only going to select the very best among us and the most stable, and the people who represent the least risk of psychological decompensation. So my short answer is, I think that they're going to be professionals and they're going to do their job well, and we won't see profound psychological problems.
So I think we better finish up there, but I'd just like to thank our four speakers for their fantastic talks and everyone for your great questions. And to Thomas and the Moon Village Association for inviting us up here.
Yeah.